Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young, broadcasting today from KGOU in Norman, Oklahoma.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And tonight, the vice presidential candidates, Mike Pence and Tim Kaine, will participate in their first and only debate. The first Clinton-Trump debate was the most watched debate in history. That is not expected to be repeated tonight, but still an important moment for the two campaigns as Trump's campaign looks to rebound from a rocky week since that first debate, and Clinton hopes to hold on to her post-debate bounce. Joining us now is NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Hey, Jeremy.
And we have to start with a kind of a depressing statistic, which is that a number of voters, many voters, don't know anything. They can't even name the two vice presidential candidates. Roughly a third have no opinion or have never heard of Tim Kaine or Mike Pence. So give us a little refresher on who these two guys are.
You know, it's not surprising that most people haven't that much information about these two guys because they're much more associated with the politics of their state. Tim Kaine, as governor of Virginia, he was first the mayor of Richmond and lieutenant governor and then senator from Virginia, but really has not been a national figure. Mike Pence was a congressman from Indiana and actually rose in the ranks of Republicans in the House, but then went back to his home state to get elected governor 4 years ago and really has not been on national television very much until he got this nomination.
And Kaine, by the way, has said that they really haven't talked much, the two of them. In fact, just one time, a quick phone call when Kaine was added to the presidential ticket.
You know, people think that members of Congress talk to each other, but members of the House and members of the Senate do not talk to each other very much. So it's really not all that surprising that someone could serve in one chamber or the other, particularly not in the same party, and not really have that much of a relationship.
So do you expect them to be combative with each other tonight?
Not in the sense that we have seen with the two people at the top of the ticket. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton obviously were quite combative in their first debate, are expected to be every bit as much combative in their second debate, and are pretty much combative every day of the week. So it's hard to reach that standard. It is unusually brackish for a presidential election. Oftentimes, the vice presidential candidates are expected to mix it up more. They're supposed to play the role of attack dog. That seems rather quaint at the moment because we have had a series of rather more mild-mannered vice presidential nominees. And Joe Biden, who trades very heavily on his likability and affability. So to think back to the attack dog vice presidents takes you back some while. And certainly we have gone much further in the mild direction with both Tim Kaine and Mike Pence, two guys who are known in their late 50s as family men, as straight arrows, as religious people to an unusual degree, people for whom religion is a very major part of their lives.
Well, yesterday we spoke with Alan Lichtman, a professor of history at American University, about the challenges that Kaine and Pence face tonight. Here's some of what he said.
You've got to do everything in your power to pump up the candidate that is at the top of the ticket, but, you know, not fading away entirely yourself. That's the tightrope that vice presidential candidates have to walk.
Ron, how much do you expect them to talk about the candidates at the top rather than themselves?
They know that the viewers are turning in to see them, to meet them, but they expect them to move on to talking about Trump and Clinton, just like pretty much everybody else throughout this entire cycle. So we know they're going to talk about those candidates. We know they're going to be as positive as they can be about a couple of candidates who have very high disapproval numbers. And we know that they're also going to find every opportunity they can to tear down the other party's top of the ticket. So we're going to hear Tim Kaine tie Mike Pence to the kinds of positions that he thinks will hurt Donald Trump in the general election. On, for example, having to do with abortion, having to do with choice, having to do with gay rights, and certainly having to do with taxes because the Democrats are trying to keep the emphasis on taxes. I also expect you would see Mike Pence going after Hillary Clinton with regard to her trustworthiness, with regard to some of her other vulnerabilities, and he will certainly try to contrast that with what he sees as the greater probity of the Republican Party.
Ron, I want to ask you before we let you go about one other thing beside the vice presidential debate, the kind of gaffe du jour. This is Donald Trump speaking yesterday in Herndon, Virginia, talking during a panel interview at the Retired American Warriors PAC.
When people come back from war and combat and they see things that maybe a lot of the folks in this room have seen many times over, and you're strong and you can handle it, but a lot of people can't handle it.
Some people took offense to those comments, seemingly saying that those soldiers suffering from PTSD or veterans who had committed suicide weren't strong enough to handle it. Here's Vice President Biden responding.
I don't think he was trying to be mean. He is just so thoroughly, completely uninformed.
Ron, just a few seconds left, but does this matter, this back and forth?
This has a lot in common with the kind of out-of-context statements that have hurt Hillary Clinton so far in the campaign about so many of Donald Trump's supporters being deplorables and about some of Sanders' supporters living in their parents' basements. These are comments taken out of context that don't really speak to the meaning of what the candidate was trying to say. Donald Trump was actually trying to say that PTSD victims need more help from the government and need more sympathy. Ultimately, that was the point he was trying to make. But these kinds of comments are going to be taken out of context on both sides because they're great fodder for media attacks.
NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Thanks, Ron.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, college students might watch tonight's debates huddled around a dorm room TV or at the student center, but it's more likely they'll do as more and more millennials do and view content exclusively on iPads, tablets, laptops, and smartphones. And campus cable providers are adapting. The Philadelphia-based cable giant Comcast is trying to take the lead and preserve its business model in the process. Avi Wolfman-Arendt from Here and Now contributor WHYY has more.
If college students can count on one thing as they return to campus this fall, it's this. A constant barrage of people trying to get them to sign up for stuff.
Come join Penn Association for Gender Equity!
You look like you might just be interested in sound. Do you like sound?
On this particular Tuesday at the University of Pennsylvania, the sign-up sheets are for student clubs, but it could easily be credit cards or bank accounts, or this year, for the first time, a new television service.
Xfinity on Campus is a leading TV streaming solution for universities and colleges, and it's revolutionizing the entertainment experience for students who live on campus. We're going to go talk.
Comcast launched Xfinity on Campus 2 years ago at 7 colleges around the country. This year, 63 have the service. Xfinity on Campus is like your regular cable hookup with two major twists. One, students can stream live television onto their laptops, tablets, or phones and access shows on demand. Two, it comes with a cloud-based DVR that can store up to 20 hours of programming.
This is a product that's designed really for today's students.
Frank Purcell is Comcast's Senior Director of Product Marketing in the Philadelphia region.
College students, I think, are important to most any market. It's always an indicator of what's coming. And, you know, we can certainly, you know, acknowledge that the way that people consume video content is changing dramatically right now.
Those changes aren't necessarily welcome ones for Comcast. The company built its media empire on traditional pay service television, says Michael Goodman, an industry analyst at the firm Strategy Analytics.
Fast forward to today, and we have the democratization of television that you can pretty much watch anything you want, anytime you want, on any kind of device that you want. And who is leading this charge? The millennials.
Thanks to the rise of streaming services such as Netflix, Hulu, and Amazon Prime, young people are watching less and less content on cable television. That trend is particularly pronounced among millennials who live on their own.
And so it really is critical for Comcast's long-term future to create a relationship with these people as early as you can.
Back on Penn's campus, it's clear that students here, like junior Anya Newhouse, still watch plenty of television.
I just finished Freaks and Geeks. Now I am working through True Detective Season 1. But yeah, I watch a lot of other shows.
Newhouse and her roommate Emmy Hancock have a television, but it's more like an accessory.
Usually we just hook up our computer to the TV and stream from our computer, but the TV allows us to see it on a bigger screen, so that's why we have a TV.
College students have always been a sought-after demographic, both because of their youth and because of their earning potential once they leave school. To lure them, Comcast has rolled Xfinity on campus into students' residential and activity fees. Essentially, students don't have a choice. As soon as they enroll, they are Xfinity on campus customers. The service also comes with some programming options, like HBO, including hits such as Game of Thrones, that aren't available on other platforms. The question now is whether students will actually use the service, says Colin Dixon, an industry analyst and founder of the research firm Endscreen.
The bet that Comcast is making here is that they can get them hooked on television so that when they leave college, they subscribe. And I'm just not sure that that's a good bet right now.
Dixon thinks Xfinity on Campus is a clever product, but it doesn't capture all the new types of shows young people are watching, like videos posted on YouTube.
For them, entertainment is not a one-way street. It's a two-way street. They have a relationship with the YouTube stars that they follow. So I'm just not sure that TV will resonate with them in the same way that it does with the rest of us.
Yes, the revolution is coming. Comcast can only hope it'll be televised. For Here and Now, I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And we're visiting KGOU in Norman, Oklahoma today. It's a state of vibrant Indian nations. Later this week, we're going to take a look at efforts to preserve the Chickasaw language. But today, racial strife in Tulsa, today and back in the day, after Terrence Crutcher, an unarmed black man, was shot and killed by white police officer Betty Jo Shelby in Tulsa. Officer Shelby, who said she feared for her life even though Crutcher was walking away from her and she had backup, was arraigned last Friday on manslaughter charges. There have been protests in the Greenwood District of Tulsa, which may sound familiar to many, but apparently has also been forgotten by many more. It's the site of the Tulsa race riots early summer 1921, when a white mob burned down black-owned homes and businesses and killed up to 300 blacks. We want to take a look at how events then and now are intersecting. Bruce Fisher, recently retired as the curator of African-American projects at the Oklahoma Historical Society. His family was driven out of Tulsa at the time of the riots. Bruce joins us in the studio. Hi. And we're also joined by KGOU reporter Kate Carlton Greer. She's been following what's happening in Tulsa today after the shooting of an unarmed black man. And Kate, welcome to you as well.
Thanks, Robin.
And Bruce, hold on there. I want to start with Kate. Just what's the status with the protests of that shooting? What's going on now?
Well, the protests are largely calmed down. Reverend Al Sharpton was out last week and led a pretty big protest there in the Greenwood area that you mentioned. But now it's pretty calm. I expect that when the trial starts, protests will start to ramp up again.
Well, we were chatting earlier with our midday anchor here at KGOU, Storm Jones, who was saying, well, you know, he wasn't sure he was even taught the Tulsa riots in school, which is relatively recent. He's very young. Is that true that people aren't even being taught it?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm hearing. They're supposed to be taught it. It's in a lot of syllabuses and requirements, but that doesn't mean that students always hear it. I grew up just a few hours down the road in Texas, and I had never known about it until I moved here. So it's not taught widespread.
Right. And there's some, if there's a requirement, it's certainly being taught differently in different schools.
Absolutely.
So, Bruce Fisher, come on in and tell us a little bit about it. There's been some conversation, but take us back. It was Memorial Day weekend, 1921. The riots started after allegations that a black man had assaulted a white woman. That young black man was arrested and supposedly protected by police. But what happened?
And what most people are unaware of is that a newspaper publisher in Tulsa, the Tulsa Star, his name was A.J. Smitherman.
Mm-hmm.
And he was so upset because of the violence around the state of Oklahoma.
Well, which is what happened was that a mob stormed the police station. The suspect ran away.
They've been doing it. Lynching is what it was all about.
Right.
Too many times African Americans were lynched. Now we're talking about shootings. But at that time, it was lynchings where mobs would literally take the people out of the jails and string them to a tree.
Right.
And this is what A.J. Smitherman was protesting against. Well, on that evening, Dick Rowland was scheduled to be incarcerated, and they decided
the suspect, yeah,
the suspect, and so the people in Greenwood who had formerly been military guys, World War One soldiers, they said not this time, and they got their guns and they went downtown to protect Dick Rowland, and they offered their services to the sheriff to help protect the prisoner.
Yeah.
Well, a shot rang out, and then the violence started, and from that point until midday the following day, it was constant shooting. There were actually two battles. One that occurred that night, in which the African Americans in Tulsa Green were able to force back the so-called deputies. It was a mob that was deputized, is what it was. Mm-hmm. And by the next morning, when daylight arrived, another battle occurred. And this is the one in which there were the allegations that the bombs had been dropped, firebombs had been dropped on African Americans. There were machine guns set up on Telegraph Hill, and they were using military equipment just like today.
Well, of course, this was a huge attack and rampage, and we're going to talk more about today. But do we understand that, you know, even children, white children, were killing blacks? I mean, we've seen reports of that.
Well, the commission to study the race riot exhibit, have received all kind of allegations. So there may have been one that's not one that I'm familiar with. But,
meanwhile, what happened to your family?
My grandfather had a church, and he, just like everybody else in every other building in Greenwood, was destroyed. And so concern and safety for his family, my grandfather, T.B. Sipio, moved to Chickasha, Oklahoma. And that's why, and that happened in a lot of cases. Many people left Tulsa. You know, my wife's mother is from Clearview, Oklahoma. And she says all of her life that she felt the anxiety of that one night. She wasn't there, but you got to understand that the word went out all around the state of Oklahoma that they were killing black people, you know, randomly and in Tulsa. And that was we didn't have, you know, the kind of mass communication that we have today. So that was, it was frightening for everybody all over the state. You know, there's a photograph in the Tulsa Race Riot photographs in the collection that is a very eerie reminder of what we see today with hands up, don't shoot. You know, you see them marching down the street. Until I thought about it a while ago, we have a photo in our collection that really shows that same thing.
The blacks with their hands up but being shot. Yeah. Well, it's so funny you say until you thought about it a while ago, but because do we understand, even with your family leaving, and by the way, we should say that Greenwood was called the Black Wall Street. It was a thriving, although segregated community, decimated after this. As you say, your mom is one of those who said she'd never go back to Tulsa. But even with all of that in your family history, you didn't even realize the impact on your family until much later in life because you also weren't taught in school.
Exactly. 1999 is when the pieces of the puzzle began to come together. My mother had told me about the Tulsa Race Riot many times growing up, but we weren't receiving that reinforcement in research projects and newspapers. Black History Month didn't cover it.
Well, you started to say newspapers. You found one newspaper. Was it in the library?
Well, the archives. Before that night, on the day of May 21st, there was an article that appeared in the paper, midday paper, says that it was inciting people to come to the jailhouse so they could lynch Dick Rowland. And strangely enough, by the next day, all of the copies of that newspaper had either been had that newspaper article cut out. So even if you look at the newspapers at the Oklahoma Historical Society, that section of the paper is cut out. There was a national search that went out during the commission's work to try to find a newspaper with that article in it, but they couldn't find one. But they all found that spot cut out.
Cut out. That's amazing. Kate Carlton Greer, come back in here. So as you're covering the shooting today of an unarmed black man, and a white officer has been charged, you know, what are you hearing people say? I mean, are they connecting dots? What's happening?
You know, it's interesting. There are some people that connect the dots, some people like Bruce. But by and large, people aren't talking about the current shootings and relating them back to the race riots. It's just maybe this feeling in the air that's more there. It feels familiar. It feels like something that's happened in the past because it has.
Yeah. And in fact, you spoke to the sister of Terrence Crutcher.
Yeah, I spoke to Tiffany Crutcher. That's Terrence's twin sister. And she's one that's connected the dots. She says, you know, this is a chain of events.
The chain breaks here. We're going to break the chains of injustice. We're going to break the chains of police brutality.
Yes, yes, yes.
The chain breaks here right in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And so I'm challenging everyone from all different walks of life to join with us.
And make sure history doesn't repeat itself. Listen, there is even more recent history. There was a shooting of a black man by that volunteer reserve deputy, Robert Bates. He said at the time he thought he was using his stun gun on the suspect. We remember that case. That was just, I can't believe that was just a year ago.
Yeah, it was April 2015. And he actually is behind bars right now. He was charged with second degree manslaughter. And he's spending 4 years in prison right now.
Yeah, for shooting someone that, and people questioned why he was even out there with the police.
Sure.
As a volunteer. Bruce Fisher, what would you like to see happen? There has been relative calm here. Should there be, you know, conversations, people brought to historical societies to be reminded, talks in classrooms? What would you like to see?
Every year, May 31st, there's an organization in Tulsa that is part of the John Hope Franklin Memorial, Reconciliation Memorial. And they try to remind people every year, you know, that this event occurred and that we must not forget it.
Yeah, but, Kate, I'm sure you're hearing from the police who say they have a very difficult job. They are not the police of 1921 who would give up a suspect to an irate mob. And the officer who's been charged in this recent shooting says she's got a lot of support. How do you heal that divide?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough one. The DA, when he filed charges against Officer Shelby, said that she became emotionally involved to the point where she overreacted. And so there's this thought that all cops aren't perfect, but by and large, they're not the cops of 1921. They're not knocking down doors and burning down houses. But for the members of the minority community, it feels a little eerily similar in this town where race relations have been a struggle.
Well, we should say, Bruce, I'm sure you want to encourage people to go to the Greenwood Cultural Center where you can see this history.
Absolutely. And the Oklahoma Historical Society.
Yeah. That's Bruce Fisher, retired curator of African American projects at the Oklahoma Historical Society. His family had to flee Tulsa during the race riots of 1921. And Kate Carlton Greer, reporter at KGOU here in Norman, Oklahoma, who's been covering the shooting of an unarmed black man by a white police officer in Tulsa. And Kate, we'll continue to follow that story with you. Thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Not all ingredients are created equal. Blue Apron sources fresh, high-quality ingredients and sends them right to your home in pre-measured packages. You get easy-to-follow recipes so you can have a meal ready in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
If you're looking for a new piece of art to display in your home, you can search a local gallery or do what lots of galleries are doing these days, checking out Instagram. Hadi Mawagdi of KERA in Dallas has more.
Dan Lamb is a 28-year-old artist, and she creates sculptures out of polyurethane foam, acrylic paint, and epoxy resin. They sort of look like alien creatures or melting blobs, and the internet loves them. For that, she credits Instagram. Lamb has nearly 85,000 followers on Instagram, and about 75,000 of them started following her this year.
The amount of exposure that I've gotten has been unreal, and I think that kind of exposure is something that normally in the past might have happened over the course of years, and it happened in the course of like 8 months for me.
Even celebrities like Miley Cyrus follow her, and Cyrus has purchased Lamb's work. Lamb's average pieces go for about $1,200, but her larger sculptures go for as much as $4,500. And Lamb says Instagram helps artists like her get into galleries.
Galleries find me on Instagram. They reach out to me and they ask me to be a part of shows. It's crazy. It's crazy.
For years, gallery owners and curators have relied upon history, their own judgment, and changing cultural tastes to determine which artists they will show. Instagram is changing that, linking art and artists directly to the public.
The value of art is inherently social. And until now, we've had no real mechanism for being able to see the social validation of an individual artist's work.
That's Marian Maniker. He's the publisher of Art Market Monitor, a website that covers the global art market. Maniker says that proof on social media of people liking your work is a powerful tool for artists.
The great thing about Instagram is it seems to have opened up a field for artists who might not have had the connections to developing a market.
Manneker believes that Instagram has created broader interest in art and artists who aren't managing to fit themselves through the thin straw that feeds the New York or London art market. Instagram has also become part of the strategy for galleries. It helps them find new artists for their showrooms, and it also attracts potential customers into their spaces.
Nowadays, you can tag people on Instagram and they're going to see it.
That's Lauren Childs. She's the creative director and an artist at Fort Works Art in Fort Worth, Texas. And she says communicating through Instagram is way more effective than Facebook or a press release. Her evidence? Well, me.
I remember, you know, when you walked into the gallery, your question was, okay, who's been tagging me on Instagram? And it got you in here.
Muralist Douglas Hoxima, also known as Hox, says he uses Instagram to see what other artists are working on.
It's just really good to know where you're at and where you're coming from, understanding your precedent, understanding in the contemporary world, like what's being done and where and why and how. And
Dan Lamb agrees, and she says there's an even cooler perk.
Art trades, huge. So this is a big part of Instagram for me, is trading with other artists. If an artist reaches out to me and they're like, how much is a piece of yours, and I like their work, I'm like, let's just trade.
If only legendary rivals Henri Matisse and Pablo Picasso had Instagram. For Here and Now, I'm Hadi Mawagdi in Dallas.
It's Here and Now at KGOU in Norman, Oklahoma, a city which is also home, who knew, to the country's largest archive of political ads.
What we've got, everything that we've got on digital now. But this is the physical archive.
Oh, we're going into the vault, I can tell. Yeah, keys are coming out.
Yeah. So this is media dating back till the 1950s.
That's Dave Bass, archive media specialist at the Julian Cantor Political Commercial Archive at Oklahoma University. He showed us videos in the meat locker-like vault.
Yes, so pretty much every format that you can think of. This is film back here. So this is kept it right above freezing, like in the low 30s.
It's like a freezer filled with film. Lisa Henry is lead archivist. She says the long view of political ads is instructive.
People talk every year about how negative, every election year, how negative everything has become. But I look back, and it's been negative since it was in print. And I had some great ones.
Like what?
Son of a corn pone eaten, wasn't hoe, but something equivalent.
Let me see what some of these are.
There are over 160,000 broadcast ads here from 1936 to today, collected but also sent by people who want them preserved. We began looking through the vast computer database for sound with Pat Merrick, chair of the Department of Communications. He started with the first paid television ads purchased by Dwight Eisenhower in 1952.
Rosser Reeves was an ad man who convinced the Eisenhower campaign to do television ads. To essentially kind of sell a candidate as though he were soap.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Hang out the banner, beat the drum, we'll take Ike to Washington.
We don't want John,
or Dean,
or Harry.
Let's do that big job right. Let's get in step with the guy that's hep. Get in step with Ike. You like Ike.
So, Pat Merrick, the one thing that jumps out at me of this early Eisenhower, maybe one of the first TV ads, it's so positive.
Yeah, well, they were big on jingles back then. You had a jingle from Stevenson, 1960. Kennedy had a famous Kennedy. And, you know, the idea was you sell candidates the way that you sell other products. You actually start seeing negative ads pretty early on as well. In 1956, the Stevenson-Kefauver campaign ran a series of ads called How's That Again, General? And actually used segments of Eisenhower ads from 1952, where Eisenhower was Eisenhower Answers America, and he was answering people's questions about inflation. And then they'd say, but inflation's higher than it's ever been. That was another broken promise.
How's that again, General? In the 1952 campaign, the general complained about the cost of living. He promised his television audience,
if people can afford less butter, less fruit, less bread, less milk. Yes, it's time for a change.
How's that again, General?
Yes, it's time for a change.
This is Estes Kefauver. The General's promise to bring down prices was another broken promise.
Since the Republicans took office, the cost of living has reached its highest point in history.
But it's so primitive. It's just Estes Kefauver standing in front of a list of names pointing out how they got benefits from General Eisenhower.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In terms of kind of the visuals, we're really pretty early on. And the candidate's presentation, too, also not getting to the point where they appear comfortable on camera.
Well, candidates became more comfortable on camera and comfortable with attacks, although we're reminded here that on his deathbed, Republican strategist Lee Atwater apologized for the naked cruelty of his attacks on the Democrat Mike Dukakis. Often the nastiest ads come at the local level, where it's personal. In Iowa in 2014, Bob Quast ran a disturbingly cheerful gun rights ad in his Senate run, referencing his sister's murder and a warning, using language which aired, but will bleep.
I believe in every aspect of our Constitution, which even a baby knows includes the Second Amendment. If you are the sexual predator and sociopath who murdered my sister Lynette, and you come to my front door to do harm to my girls, I'm going to use my Glock to blow your off.
You've got many of these. You know, we would never hear that, ever hear that across the country.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what our purpose is, to try to collect as many of these as we can and preserve them.
Because what do they mean? I mean, that one obviously unique to that man and that race. What do ads mean to us?
They are responses to the conditions in that time, in that state, that community. But we're also kind of capturing, you know, it's a little time capsule of the zeitgeist of American culture, too.
One of our colleagues here was just mentioning a great ad that he saw in Missouri that featured somebody saying they were going to dump manure or something. And you said what?
I said, I bet we could find a dozen ads that feature manure.
What else? Can you think of themes that show up in ads?
Classic is the flip-flop and the visuals that go with the flip-flop. If you go back to 1972, there was a McGovern ad that showed McGovern taking positions one way on the Vietnam War, then the other way, and then
flip-flop.
Yeah, and kind of said, showed the card with the two sides of McGovern starting to rotate faster and faster. Of course, the Kerry windsurfing ad in 2004.
In which direction would John Kerry lead? Kerry voted for the Iraq War, opposed it, supported it, and now opposes it again.
Let's do a couple more landmarks. The beginning of speaking to Hispanic voters. Jackie Kennedy had one of the first ads.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that she was able to speak fluently in Spanish herself helped to kind of personalize that appeal.
Nuestro país está pasando por un periodo de gran peligro. Nos amenazan de afuera la tiranía comunista.
This was a period where the communist takeover of Cuba was relatively fresh in people's minds, very relevant at the time.
And they were Catholic?
Yes.
Every thinking patriotic American favors this country building up its national defenses at once.
Before the TV ads, there were short films like this one for Wendell Willkie, the Republican, running against the Democratic incumbent president FDR in 1940.
No one today disputes the need for a powerful army, navy, and air force for our national defense. For these taxes are willingly paid.
But essentially, this is buying time in theaters before television is in homes and trying to reach audiences who are used to maybe seeing some newsreels, maybe some comic shorts before and between their features, and reach out to them with a paid message that way.
Draw the line to what we're seeing today. When you look, and you do, you guys get to see 50 years ago and then today. What are some of your thoughts about the comparison? I mean, it's pretty much the same in some ways.
Yes, the kinds of themes often kind of stay the same. The idea that you use a candidate's past words against them. Look at Hillary Clinton's ads. They are almost exclusively clips of Donald Trump speaking.
We drew the line from some of the 1950s Eisenhower where his opponents just repeated his words. Mm-hmm. That's, as you said, what Hillary Clinton's doing. Let's listen to just a little.
You know, you could see there was blood coming out of her eyes, blood coming out of her wherever.
Does she have a good body? No. Does she have a fat ass? Absolutely.
You like girls that are 5'1", they come up to you nowhere. If
Ivanka were themes with regard to, you know, opportunity and economic growth and those kinds of concerns are fairly enduring. Security, crime, we see certainly a lot from Trump, but we saw them from Nixon, Goldwater.
And in fact, you're not seeing them from Trump this time around. It's maybe PACs that support Donald Trump. What do you think about that? The fact that he, up until recently, hasn't spent anything on advertising.
He had an ad on during Sunday Night Football. That was a national ad buy attacking Hillary Clinton. So he's begun to spend, but not nearly. We're orders of magnitude below the level of spending that the Clinton campaign has bought so far.
Can you think of another candidate who, I mean, nobody has ever not done anything which he has, so he's there's a first there, but can you compare it to another candidate who didn't have to do as much ad buying because he was getting so much coverage?
I really can't think of one, no. And, you know, there is concern, I think, from advertising professionals that it's harder for ads to break through because people have TiVo, people are watching Netflix, and, you know, the chance that any given ad is actually going to be seen gets lower and lower. But there's also the internet, and people who are interested can seek out ads. They get shared virally on social media. So I don't know if we should be writing the obituary for the political ad just yet.
Well, if they do die, they will be buried here. Thanks. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Pat Merrick, chair of the Department of Communication at the University of Oklahoma. We also spoke with lead archivist Lisa Henry and media expert David Bass. Their political ad archive is open to the public for more and some of the ads. How about that one from Iowa? Go to hereandnow.org.
Google is making an aggressive push into the hardware industry. Today at the company's high-profile Made by Google event in San Francisco, it announced a new line of products, including a virtual reality headset, an at-home search assistant, and its first branded smartphone called Pixel. Here with more is our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Johanna Buya is senior editor at Recode. She joins us from San Francisco. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And let's talk about this phone. Some people may hear Google's announced a new phone and think, why is this a big deal? So why is this a big deal?
I mean, up until the Pixel, Google basically hasn't had its own phone in the same way Apple has, you know, had an iPhone. You know, typically Google has partnered with companies like Samsung and HTC to sort of co-develop a phone that operates on the Android system. Pixel, for the first time, you know, is Google's phone. They'll be partnering with a company like HTC, reportedly, to sort of assemble the phone and manufacture it in the same way that Apple partners with Foxconn. But now this is the first real Google phone.
But I imagine that companies like Samsung are not going to be happy to hear this, given that Google, Google's operating system is on their phone.
No, definitely. I mean, it's no secret that if, you know, Google now owns a product and is now developing its own product, that will become the priority for them. So I don't think that this is great for them, though, you know, access to Android OS is not going to be cut off.
So why did Google finally decide to make its own hardware?
Yeah, during the event, they talked about this quite a few times. Rick Osterloh, the new head of the hardware division, mentioned a number of times that there is such a huge opportunity in controlling both the software and hardware end of it. And you could see in the phone that they talked about how, you know, the difference or the different ways that, you know, pressing down the home button sort of activated different aspects of that the software and some sort of features and sort of how that kind of collaborated. And that's not an opportunity that Google didn't have previously when partnering with other companies.
Google also announced today a virtual reality headset. Tell us about that.
The virtual reality headset, I mean, I think of the hardware that they've announced was a little bit less exciting, although it is completely different than in terms of the aesthetics than other virtual reality headsets that we've seen. It's created using cloth. Their comfort is really prioritized in the creation of it. But I think what was really, really exciting was kind of the Amazon Home competitor that Google announced, particularly because Amazon sort of went into this market that Google has owned for so long. You know, search and categorizing all of the internet's information is what Google is at its core, and it's what it does best. So to have Amazon kind of go into the market with a product like Alexa and Amazon Home, it was a huge problem for Google, because if another company is owning that search space and owning that machine learning space, Google is at risk of becoming irrelevant. But the product seemed pretty promising and on par with Amazon's Home product.
And you've gotten, by the way ahead of me in terms of where I am with the technology of my home. So what does this product do?
In the same way that Amazon Home sort of controls, or you can say Alexa, you know, please, you know, play this music, play that music. Google's product also does that as well. But it also controls, you know, Chromecast. You can use your phone assistant to, or it controls things on your phone. And so it's a single assistant across all of your Google devices.
While we have you, you recently got a tour of Google's self-driving car. What did you find there? Because they're not the only one trying to do a self-driving car.
Definitely. I mean, Google has had a self-driving car, you know, project since 2009, and they've been working on this for a while. So, and a lot of people have been exposed to what the Google car looks like. But what was interesting to me is that the technology has developed so much in the time that they've created it. They basically started like Tesla, you know, trying to solve for autonomous driving on freeways, but then realized that you get the most benefit from self-driving technology when you're able to drive everywhere. And driving everywhere requires that you're able to not only interact with pedestrians or understand their behavior and then predict what they're going to do, but also kind of communicate your intentions. And then in order to be able to communicate that intention, you have to sort of take on the implicit language that humans use when they drive. So edging forward, you know, trying to merge into lanes by edging into that lane. It's definitely very interesting in how sophisticated the technology has gotten.
And the Google cars have been involved in 14 collisions, although 13 times other drivers were at fault. Are there still safety concerns with Google's self-driving car?
Ironically enough, self-driving technology is going to become safest in 40 years when all of the cars, you know, are self-driving. And so right now, Google and all the other companies who are trying to create self-driving cars are solving for this near-term problem where self-driving cars will be driving along humans. And so in that situation, you know, you basically want to be able to, you know, like I said, communicate with human drivers in a way that they understand, but also predict their behavior, which is right. a difficult problem.
That's Johanna Buya, who is a senior editor at Recode, as we watch what's coming out of the Google event going on in San Francisco. Johanna, thank you.
Thank you.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. We want to thank here and now producer and traveling companion Karen Miller-Medson and the crew here at KGOU in Norman, Oklahoma, especially news director Jacob McClelland and our pilot, our engineer Patrick Roberts. This is Here and Now.